supporters, this is really not acceptable to them, because Trump has ran his entire campaign basically saying that mail-in votes are going to be fraud, they're going to steal the election, and Trump supporters really believe this. And the Democrats haven't helped this, to be completely honest, the way they've went after Trump with scandal after scandal. For instance, Russiagate was one of the big ones, which they went after Trump with, and that turned out to be completely incorrect and false. And so Trump supporters feel like they're hard done to, they feel like they're being cheated. Of course, there's no evidence that has emerged at this point that there has been fraud, but people feel this way. And of course, if armed groups are going to get involved in these protests, if armed groups are going to go and stop the votes from being counted, they could pressure them to stop counting votes. And they could declare that there is no winner on the 11th if all the votes are not counted. This is a possible scenario. And if Joe Biden is declared the winner, then this could result in a large amount of violence in the United States. We've already seen that coming to fruition.
That may well happen, Robert. And everybody is saying that every claim he has made regarding mail-in ballots and everything else, it's been debunked. I mean, you watch Fox News, some of the pundits on Fox News are even agreeing with the rest of the country that these claims are not grounded in facts. What has the online reaction been to this?
Well, of course, online you've got Trump supporters and those who are absolutely against him. We pulled up a few here, one saying Trump throwing out lies to his base to incite violence. U.S. elections are monitored by international observers who debunked Trump's lies and paranoia. We have another one here as well, saying that Donald Trump has just sent text messages to supporters seemingly calling for violence, saying, "I need you. The left will try and steal this election. I'm calling on you to step up and fight back." So that's pretty damning if that in fact did go out.
All right, let's go all the way to the Middle East, the U.S.'s ally there, and the demolition by the Israeli military of a large portion of a Palestinian community in the West Bank that has left 73 people, including 41 children, homeless, Robert.
Yes, unfortunately, the Israelis have yet again used the U.S. election and the coverage of that basically as a cloak in order for them to get away with this massive expulsion inside of the Jordan Valley. The Jordan Valley also is a place where Israel has been talking about annexing for some time, so they have to ethnically cleanse these communities and get them out of there so that they can go ahead and seize that land. I mean, already you've got 85% of it as a closed military zone, many settlers moving in there. And so I've been to the Jordan Valley myself and seen when they have demolished these villages, and it's not a pretty sight. There were 70 plus structures which were destroyed by Israel. This left at least 73 Palestinians homeless. Over 40 of them were children. And really, we've seen little to no coverage of this. It was done at a time where there were little cameras on the event. And also on top of this, this runs in tandem with what's been happening in East Jerusalem al-Quds, where Israel has essentially this year broken all previous records for home demolitions in Jerusalem al-Quds, yet we have not seen this reported at all. I mean, Israeli human rights organization B'Tselem's pointed this out, and many other human rights organizations have been sounding the alarms, yet we've seen absolutely no coverage of this. And also inside of what is regarded as Israel, inside of the Zionist entity itself and the land that it claims as its own, we've seen every single year for the past 3 years, 2,000 Palestinian homes in the Al-Naqab, or the Negev, some people may know it as by its Hebrew name, have been destroyed. So this ethnic cleansing is ongoing, and it's been going on since 1947, and it's never stopped.
All right, thanks for bringing that story to light, giving it due coverage, Robert. Bring us the online reaction to what's been happening in the occupied territories.
The first one we have here is by a Twitter user called Beltrue, who says, "While everyone was distracted by the U.S. election, Israel just carried out its largest demolition in a decade, displacing dozens of Palestinians in the West Bank. More than 73 people, including 41 children, were made homeless despite coronavirus pandemic." And then we've got another one here as well who says, "Shame on the Arab countries with that ridiculous peace agreement." And many people are saying, are questioning, you know, what pieces came out of these so-called peace agreements, these normalization deals.
All right, Robert in Lakesh with those stories. Robert, thank you. And while we're talking Palestine, pro-Palestine activist Nazem Ali has been cleared of all charges accusing the pharmacist of making anti-Semitic comments during an Al Quds rally in 2017. The verdict, handed down by the General Pharmaceutical Council, a governmental regulatory body, means Ali is now free to continue practicing his profession. He was issued with a warning, but had faced being suspended or struck off. The three-year legal battle, first launched by Campaign Against Anti-Semitism, accused Mr. Ali of being anti-Semitic, according to the controversial IHRA definition, which conflates criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism. And let's talk about that story with Robert Carter, who's been following it for us. Robert, good to see you. So 3 years of a legal battle are now over. How was Nazem Ali when you saw him?
Well, obviously, it's been a very long fought battle. Over 3 years now, Nazem Ali has been in and out of court, fighting for his name and reputation. And obviously, throughout that period, it's come at great financial and stressful cost to Nazem, who is, of course, a lifelong anti-racism, pro-Palestine activist. But this has essentially been what he's described as an attempt at character assassination on his part. And it's taken over 3 years now for him to actually prove that to be the case. The fact is, the only thing he's guilty of is just speaking out in support of Palestine. Obviously, he admits that a lot of the things he said were indeed offensive, and he has already apologized for that fact. But ultimately, you know, he's had several court cases now. This is, I think, at least the third court case that he's been able to successfully win.
Yeah.
Each time round, they've admitted that it's not
racist. And they make mention of it, Robert, on their website, the Campaign Against Anti-Semitism, that they have tried in the past to do the same, to no avail. Let's tell us what this outcome means for the pro-Palestinian cause in Britain.
Well, obviously, I think we can see it as a success story. Obviously, this is just one of many activists that have been hounded in this way and hit with this smear campaign to try and, you know, destroy their reputation, destroy their careers, and hit them where it hurts, which is in their private and financial life. So obviously, in that sense, it's a victory. But going forward, Nazem even admitted that, you know, he's going to have to be careful of what he says. He's going to have to rethink about whether or not he'll continue his activities publicly, because obviously we live in an era now where freedom of speech on Palestine doesn't really exist in the UK. People who are pro-Palestine and outspoken in their criticism of Israel can easily find their careers damaged, hounded in society. They can end up in court, as you can see. And these are long, drawn-out processes. And pro-Israel activists know that, obviously, this is a tactic of intimidation. Even if they can't beat activists like Nazem legally, it can cause significant financial cost to them in order to fight for their name, and also significant stress, which will make activists think twice about speaking out for Palestine and condemning Israel in the future. So obviously, it's a hard-fought battle, which we have to keep fighting, but certainly we have to be very careful, as there are people looking out for opportunities to smear and to get people sent to court when they haven't said anything illegal.
All right, freedom of speech on Palestine doesn't exist. That's the quote from this interview, Robert Carter. Thank you very much. Moving on now, hundreds of anti-lockdown protesters took to the streets of London Thursday evening, on the same day England's second national lockdown went into effect. The demonstrators chanted freedom and no more lockdowns, despite a heavy police presence and COVID-19 restrictions. London's Metropolitan Police said they made 104 arrests, most of them for breaches of coronavirus regulations. The annual protest known as the Million Mask March is an anti-government demo, which typically falls on the anniversary of Guy Fawkes' attempt to blow up Parliament. German police have raided the homes and businesses of four men linked to the Takfiri extremist who carried out a deadly attack in Vienna this week. Police say while the men are not currently suspected of involvement in Monday's shooting, there is evidence they had links to the attacker. Four people were killed and 20 others wounded when the gunman opened fire on people outside cafes and restaurants. The attacker also wounded a police officer before he was shot dead. An update now on the COVID-19 pandemic in Europe. Belgian health authorities say they fear hospitals could run out of beds for COVID patients by the end of the week. The country has reported 500,000 confirmed cases and over 12,000 deaths so far. In Denmark, the government has announced tougher restrictions in parts of the country after health authorities discovered that a mutated strain of coronavirus in minks could be passed on to animals. It said it would cull up to 17 million of the animals to prevent a spread to humans. Greece has become the latest European country to impose a three-week national lockdown in the face of rising infections there. The country has had over 49,000 confirmed cases and north of 700 deaths. And now to Bahrain, a Persian Gulf nation notorious for its human rights abuses and for having the largest number of political prisoners in relation to population. The British government's role in propping up the regime is common knowledge, but names are now surfacing. Influential British figures have been advising King Hamad of Bahrain to solidify their strategic alliance. Here's more.
On the 14th of March 2011, Bahraini security forces began a violent crackdown on protests demanding greater political participation, free and fair elections, and an end to corruption and equality for the country's suppressed Shia majority. It has now been revealed that the UK's top military officer, General Sir David Richards, was in Manama holding meetings with the country's senior military officials and the Crown Prince 5 days earlier. In the brutal crackdown, Bahrain security forces were backed by 1,000 UK-trained and equipped Saudi troops. Since then, almost all prominent human rights defenders and dissidents have been jailed, silenced, or forced into permanent exile. The main opposition party, Al-Wefaq, has been dissolved, and the country's only independent newspaper, Al-Wasat, forcibly closed down. Torture is widespread in Bahrain's prisons, especially for the purpose of extracting confessions that are used to sentence people to death. And the country has the largest number of political prisoners in relation to population.
We have interviewed people, men, women, and children, who have been tortured by the regime. Children who have been snatched from the streets by armed gangs and have been then beaten and driven around the streets. One boy had his teeth knocked in, and they are forced then to inform on family members or friends or people that they know in the villages who have attended democratic protests or have attended political gatherings. Inside the prisons, people have been waterboarded, they've been beaten with truncheons on their bare bodies and on their feet, they've been hung for hours, days, and deprived of sleep. They have been anally raped with truncheons. They have been just the cruelest, most inhumane treatment.
Nonetheless, the British government continues to support the regime. When construction began on a new permanent naval base in Bahrain in 2015, then UK Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond said this.
This will give us the flexibility to respond to any emerging challenge in the Gulf, whether it's from a state actor or a non-state actor, whether it's from within the Gulf or outside the Gulf. This enhances our range. It gives Britain a permanent naval base east of Suez for the first time since 1967.
Strategic interests seem to be Westminster's priority. According to Human Rights Watch, arbitrary arrests, torture, executions, and forced disappearances continue with very little interference from so-called democracies. Bianca Rahimi, London.
More now on the U.S. presidential election. Other than the American president himself, his son, his oldest son, Donald Trump Jr., is not very happy about the direction the election vote counting is going and is calling on his father to go to war for it. Joining me now with that story and more, Richard Sudan. And Richard, a totally normal thing to say for someone confident in their own legitimate victory.
I mean, just when you thought this presidential race could not get any more controversial, any more chaotic, Donald Trump Jr., Eric Trump, waded into the debate and took to the Twitter sphere to call for all-out war. in the wake of these outlandish and unfounded claims of voter electoral fraud, I mean, it's quite a spectacular state of affairs, really. I mean, if, you know, his son and Donald Trump's fans want Donald Trump to remain in office, they're not really doing a very good advertisement for him, and certainly not regarding the state of democracy. I have to say, one of the first things that popped into my mind when I saw this tweet is, what would be the reaction if a Muslim or a black leader or one of their sons took to Twitter to make this kind of claim calling for war? One can only imagine the kind of reaction we would see. But of course, no doubt Eric Trump is going to get a pass, although Twitter has actually, as a platform, censored a lot of these comments being made by Trump Jr. and also Donald Trump. I mean, a quite incredible state of affairs, Saeed.
And what have Twitter users been saying? How did they react to that post?
It almost broke the internet, actually, Saeed. Let's go first to Mehdi Hassan, the journalist, who says, election officials are saying they fear for their lives. The president's son is calling for total war. The president's former top advisor is calling for the beheading of the FBI chief. But yeah, those of us who talk of authoritarianism and fascism, we're the alarmists, right? And we have a reaction from Volker, also on Twitter, who says, Donnie, Donald Trump, you know what really looks like a banana republic? The imbecile offspring of an unhinged leader calling for total war. So very powerful words there from Volker, and they've been echoed throughout social media, Saeed.
All right, let's stay with that family, Richard. Donald Trump's speech last night, riddled with myths and untruths yet again.
Unbelievable. As if it was even possible for this one to be the most dishonest speech of his presidency, is how it's being characterized as Biden closes in on victory. Donald Trump at about 6:30 p.m., I think Eastern time yesterday, took to the podium in the White House to deliver a barrage and litany of unfounded accusations claiming voter electoral fraud. And of course, there's no evidence to back up the president's claims, as we've become used to really since 2016. Again, to the point Twitter has took to kind of censor a lot of the information or the claims rather made by Donald Trump in the speech. I mean, it's just one outlandish, unfounded claim after another. Many found it quite excruciating to watch, to be honest with you, Saeed. And really, it's all the echoes of many people would say a sore loser who quite simply knows his time is up and is throwing everything and the kitchen sink in a desperate bid to curry favor.
Exactly, and people are saying that's always been his M.O., his modus operandi. When he finds himself cornered, he starts inciting and, like you said, throws everything in, including the kitchen sink, to try and change the situation, and oftentimes that doesn't seem to be the happening in his favor. Bring us the online reaction to it.
Sure. Let's go first to a tweet from Brianne, who says, Trump's meltdown speech is just another example of how he literally does not understand the democratic government. He's equating being president with being above the law and the rules of our country. How can you still support someone who doesn't understand how government works? Crazy, because Donald Trump still has a lot of support, Saeed. And we have a reaction here from Vicky, who says, you can blame Trump for this. He represents violence and hatred. Instead of keeping a calm speech, he dared to stand on the White House grounds and say nothing but lies, lies, lies about him probably losing the election. He is a disgrace to America. Powerful analysis there from Vicky on the Twitter sphere.
All right, and on that note, we're going to bring this broadcast to an end. Richard Sedan, thank you for those stories. And thank you. Stick around.
From east to west, throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio. the limelight. Statistics show that in the late 20th century alone, there were 118 armed conflicts around the world that displaced 6 million people and imposed devastating consequences on people and the environment. According to the Rio Declaration on Environment and Development, 1992, Articles 24 and 25, warfare is inherently destructive of sustainable development. States shall therefore respect international law, providing protection for the environment in times of armed conflict and cooperate in its further development as necessary. Peace development and environmental protection are interdependent and indivisible. Although many countries have signed the Rio Declaration, studies show that war still causes the most damage to the environment. Furthermore, the United Nations Environment Programme, UNEP, has found that over the last 60 years, at least 40% of all internal conflicts have been linked to the exploitation of natural resources, whether high-value resources such as timber, diamond, gold and oil, or scarce resources such as fertile land and water. Conflicts involving natural resources have also been found to be twice as likely to relapse. Concerning this issue, we have prepared an article written by Farhanek Bakhtiari under the heading War Footprint Never Fades Away from Nature. Please stay with us for more of Farhanek Bakhtiari's article. When a war breaks out, one of the first things which comes to mind is casualties and destruction. Whilst one of the main victims of war is the environment, because the effects of war on nature never fade away and can be seen in the food cycle and nature for a long time. War always brings to mind the destruction of houses, deserted villages, smoky cities and streets littered with war weapons and barricades. Massive explosions and ultimately misery, homelessness and death. There are the obvious signs of war, but in the meantime, the part that has been out of sight and out of mind for years is the extent of damage it does to nature, the environment and everything in it, from animals to plants. Perhaps the catastrophe of human-caused war is so great that it is no longer possible to address, whilst the long-term effects of environmental degradation and the quality of human life are determined and manifested over time. Water wells have been polluted, crops torched, forests cut down, soils poisoned, and animals killed to gain military advantage. Statistics show that in the late 20th century alone, there were 118 armed conflicts around the world, and these displaced a total of 6 million people and imposed devastating consequences on both people and the environment. According to the Rio Declaration on Environment and Development 1992, Articles 24 and 25, warfare is inherently destructive of sustainable development. Countries shall therefore respect international law, providing protection for the environment in times of armed conflict, and cooperate in its further development as necessary. Peace development and environmental protection are interdependent and indivisible. Although many countries have signed the Rio Declaration, studies show that wars still cause the most damage to the environment. Furthermore, the United Nations Environment Programme, UNEP, has found that over the last 60 years, at least 40% of all internal conflicts have been linked to the exploitation of natural resources, whether high-value resources such as timber, diamond, gold or oil, or scarce resources such as fertile land and water. Conflicts involving natural resources have also been found to be
twice as likely to relapse. The United Nations attaches great importance to ensuring that action on the environment is part of conflict prevention, peacekeeping, and peace-building strategies, because there can be no durable peace if the natural resources that sustain livelihood and ecosystems are destroyed. In 2001, the United Nations General Assembly declared 6th of November of each year as International Day for Preventing the Exploitation of the Environment in War and Armed Conflict. Since the devastation of war knows no boundaries, all countries must work together to reduce the destructive effects of war, for example, during the Iraqi-imposed war in Iran in the 1980s, in the process of which Iraq dried up the Hur al-Azim wetland to limit the operation of Iranian fighters in defending their homeland, and now years after the end of that war, the sand and dust storms have taken over Iran, which originates from the dried-up parts of Hur al-Azim wetland in neighboring Iraq. Or the invasion of Kuwait in 1990, which is another example of this negative impact. During this war, hundreds of oil wells in the Persian Gulf were set on fire, polluting vast water and marine resources, as well as polluting the air. Oil and bitumen covered hundreds of kilometers of the coast of the Persian Gulf, which killed at least 30,000 seabirds. When Daesh terrorist group occupied a large part of Iraq and Syria, leaving the agricultural lands abandoned, caused the lands to become sand and dust storm hotspots. However, the negative impact of war are not limited to these measures and effects. Its physical effects still exist, as landmines planted during the Second World War some 70 years ago still claim lives today in Europe, or landmines planted by Iraqis in Western Iranian territories during the war also are taking the lives of hundreds of innocent Iranian civilians. The deputy chief of the Department of the Environment, Masoud Tajrishi, told IRNA that one of the biggest challenges posed by conflict and war is population displacement. Putting aside the social impact of the war, the environment is the most important issue that has not received much attention. Tajrishi stated, during the 8 years of Iraqi-imposed war on Iran, we witnessed the displacement of large numbers of people in different parts of the country. He noted also, when the enemy entered Iran, invaded Iranian territory, it planted numerous mines, which made these lands unusable for a long time, even after the lands were taken back. People could not enter these lands because of fear of landmines, one of the major effects of which was sand and dust storms, as well as when Daesh terrorists controlled a large swathe of Iraqi and Syrian territory. Masoud Tajrishi regretted that also during the US-led invasion of Iraq and Kuwait, when a significant number of oil wells in the Persian Gulf were set on fire and smoke rose to miles in air, after studies shown that a significant amount of soot entered our land, settled on the soil, rain washed them into groundwater, fed on plants, animals, and humans. He lamented statistics at the Basra Hospital 3 to 4 years after the American occupied Iraq showed that many Iraqi children were born with abnormalities, as well as serious complications and diseases for the residents of the Basra area, all of which were caused by chemical weapons, which the Americans used in huge amounts in Iraqi territory, harming both the Iraqi people and the environment. However, if we are to achieve sustainable development goals, we need to act with greater urgency and coherence to reduce the threats that armed conflict pose to our environment and ultimately pose to our health and livelihood.
Shura debate.
Welcome to the debate, and my name is Gisum Shahmadi. U.S. Democratic presidential hopeful Joe Biden has reached what appears to be a crucial point in the race to the White House, taking the lead in key states where vote counting is still underway and postal ballots are tipping the scales in the Democrats' favor. However, a smooth transfer of power still seems far from certain, as the White House put out a statement insisting that this election is not over. Donald Trump and a handful of his loyalists continue to allege election fraud. In this election, in this edition of the debate, we will be taking a closer look at how deeply polarized society is bringing chaos to a country that used to put itself forward as a beacon of democracy and criticize countries where election results were challenged.
The U.S. presidential vote remained unclear days after polls ended. The Democratic challenger, Joe Biden, appears to have a slight lead over the incumbent, Donald Trump. But analysts say that Trumpism overwhelmingly beat back the mainstream media's widely predicted blue wave as conservatives maintained or increased their overall control at almost every other level of national and state government. Both candidates are being widely criticized for making statements regarding the outcome of the vote before all the votes are counted in this highly charged election. It has been seen in countless elections worldwide that any candidate who declares early is risking deadly violence for personal gain. It creates confusion, anger, and undermines the entire election process.
And just even using it as an excuse to riot and, you know, just act crazy and stuff, but definitely all the divisiveness needs to stop, and I could see a lot of violence happening, but at the same time I think also just the media is exaggerating things and acting like some crazy stuff's going to happen, but really who knows, you know what I mean? I think most people are pretty level-headed.
Prematurely declaring victory is also rather useless in highly decentralized American democracy, which does have checks and balances to executive orders. And while there have been many presidential assassinations, there have never been any open coups to take over the executive branch.
And it just drags everyone else down, unfortunately, because when this is resolved, we're still divided. There will be no coming together like there was with Bush v. Gore, or even like there was last time with, even though we still were very divided in 2016, there was still some resolution on the half of the American country.
The early declarations are not unexpected. For months, both candidates have sown doubts about the legitimacy of the election, with Trump asserting that this was the most fraudulent vote in the nation's history, while Biden repeatedly warned that Trump was attempting to steal the election. America is still counting the presidential votes, but the damage this election has wrought on the national culture appears to be immense. With both candidates flouting the necessary rules of comportment for months, the U.S. presidency may never be looked at the same again. Ramin Mazahari, Chicago.
Now to continue our discussion, we're joined by Anthony Brian Logan, conservative political commentator, and also Robert Petillo, Democratic strategist, joining us live right now. Let's begin with Mr. Logan. According to Fox News, Donald Trump does not have plans to immediately concede the election. Is it legally necessary for him to do so, and what does it mean if he doesn't?
No, I don't think so. I don't know about a law that says you must concede after an election. I think the main thing is looking at everything legally, do some vote recounting if necessary, look at some of the claims of voter fraud, votes that were found in the garbage, set on fire, look at the things that have happened, you know, investigate all the claims, approach it from a legal point of view, and then we get to the actual conclusion.
Thank you very much, Jeanette. And let's bring in Mr. Patel. What is your opinion? Do you think it's legally necessary for Donald Trump to concede?
It's not absolutely not legally necessary at all. It's a gentlemanly thing to do with respect for the office, understanding the importance of the peaceful transition of power being a hallmark of our democracy. Going back to Marbury versus Madison, what our nation has prided itself on is the peaceful transfer of power. And when we have not done that, we've seen the nation still come together thereafter. We saw in 2000 with Bush v. Gore, the nation recovered from that. We saw from the Nixon impeachment after, or the near impeachment of Nixon after Watergate, the nation still came together. So this will be a blip on the radar. I think what we do need to do is continue counting the votes and counting the ballots, ensuring that the Constitution is respected, and more so understanding that President Trump lost this election by 4 million votes in the popular vote after losing the last election by 3 million votes in the popular vote. So in two elections, we have 7 million people voting against this president, but they're still attempting to glom onto power and make it seem as though this is being taken from them. The democratic system will prevail. Our nation is stronger than any one man or any other individual. This is why it's the office of the presidency, and we do not pray to or worship the president himself.
Thank you very much. Let's go back to Mr. Logan. The shadow of a legal battle is hanging over the U.S. elections. How far do you think this can go?
It'll probably go all the way to the Supreme Court. And I think that a lot of us saw this coming before the actual election happened, because right when they said, okay, we're going to have maybe universal mail-in ballots, that opens the door right there for voter fraud. And then also you have some states where you don't have voter ID required. There's plenty of open space and gaps for fraud to happen. So I think that a lot of us saw this whole fight coming. And then as far as there being a big gap in a number of votes, of course, I mean, that may happen. You may lose the popular vote, and that's okay. But the main thing is being able to talk to everyone across the United States. So individual states that have small populations don't get overlooked. And it's not just about the states. It's about individual people as well. We want to have all the votes counted. We want to make sure we don't have dead people voting. We want to make sure that those that registered to vote are actually voting, and it's themselves voting and not someone else. No identity theft. So as soon as we get through all of the claims and all of the possible illegalities, then we'll be able to see what's really going on here.
Thank you very much, Mr. Logan. Now, Mr. Patello, when do you think the Supreme Court can step in, and will the U.S. House be able to step in according to U.S. law?
The United States House is not stepping in. The Supreme Court is not stepping in. Frankly, most of these lawsuits have already been dismissed. We had a case in Savannah, Georgia, that was dismissed by Judge Bass down there. And we've had cases, the case in Philadelphia has already been thrown out. When Republicans talk about this voter fraud, it's a completely made-up thing, because they can't point to any instance of it happening. Even when we were fighting against voter ID laws 20 years ago, they never presented any evidence of in-person voter fraud. And the compromise coming out of that was to do mail-in ballots with a paper trail to ensure that there was no voter fraud, and now they're claiming that mail-in ballots are voter fraud also. Understand, Republicans have lost the popular vote in every election except for one since 1990. In eight of the last nine presidential elections, Republicans have failed to garner the popular vote. They are a dying party with a dying ideology. So what do you do when you are a dying party with a dying ideology that does not comport with the American people, where millions of people vote against you every single election? You start playing to the refs, inventing these boogeymen of voter fraud and ballots being tossed into trash cans and set on fire, and all these other ideas that have no basis in fact or reality. And so if they can present any evidence of it happening, then maybe it will go to court, but many of these cases will simply be dismissed on procedural grounds.
Thank you very much. Let's give a chance to Mr. Logan to respond to that.
Well, yeah, I mean, some of those allegations did happen as far as ballots being set on fire. That really did happen. And you want to talk about millions voted against the Republican Party. Well, how about we almost had 70 million that voted for the Republican Party? Like I was saying before, let's not ignore these people. Let's have their voices be heard. And it's really unfair to just disenfranchise nearly half of the entire nation that voted simply because, oh, we don't want to look into it, we're Democrats, we just want to ignore it. We want to ignore all the claims, the insider, the whistleblower, the ballots that have been set on fire, ballots that have been discarded. And then there was the curious case of Wisconsin and Michigan, where they found over 100,000 votes overnight. So rather than the vote tally going up at an equal rate for both Biden and Trump, it jumps by like 100,000 votes. How does it really happen? Look into all the questions that are being raised about the election, and then we can get a greater picture. If all the questions are answered properly, and then it comes back, hey, Joe Biden is the victor, Donald Trump lost, then you take it, you accept it. But only until that point and not a second before.
Thank you very much, Mr. Logan. But I still would like you to clarify something, especially for us people looking at this from outside the U.S. Well, we've been told that it's the electoral votes that count, and the popular vote doesn't count, especially 4 years ago in the case of Hillary Clinton, where she won the popular vote, but she didn't win enough electoral votes. When you talk about election fraud, where does this popular vote count, and how can it affect the electoral votes, which is actually necessary for any of the candidates to be considered the new president of the U.S.?
Well, the popular vote does matter, because in order for a particular state to go towards one president versus the other, they must win the popular vote in that state. So the overall popular vote is kind of misleading. You got to have the popular vote for each state go towards a particular president. And the reason why that system exists is to prevent mob rule, because if not for the Electoral College, then nobody would care about the very small states, West Virginia, Idaho, Iowa, nobody would care. You focus on California, Illinois, New York, maybe Florida, and that's pretty much it, Texas, and then that'll be y'all. And all the states in between would get totally ignored. The system is to have all voices heard, not just some that some people would like to be heard.
Exactly, and especially in this case, the Electoral College does realize that there has been some vote rigging, doesn't it? Because they're the ones who have to actually vote for a certain candidate. Won't they realize that there's been fraud in the popular vote, especially in red states, for example, traditionally red states like Georgia? Mr.
Well,
Logan.
The electors... Oh, go ahead.
Please go ahead, Mr. Logan, then I'll have Mr. Patillo clear this out for us.
Well, the electors are required to vote for the state that they're that the citizens voted for. Like, okay, they have to vote for Trump. So let's say, for example, Texas. The electors in Texas must vote for Trump because Texas voted for Trump. So there's really no gray area there. I mean, there may be some voter fraud, but that's not in the hands of the electors that would go and vote for Trump from Texas. That goes to the courts and everything else.
So, Mr. Patillo, if you could please clear that out for us, looking at this from outside the U.S.
Okay, I understand. The concept of the Electoral College is a holdover from the Holy Roman Empire, where elector princes would decide on the emperor of the Holy Roman Empire prior to the Napoleonic Wars of the early 19th century in Europe. So it's a concept which is antiquated at its base. The reason that it was implemented in the United States of America was because at the time of the ratification of the Constitution in 1789, there was a concern by the Federalists that you would have states that had large populations dominating the electoral map. This is also why we had the Three-Fifths Compromise, which counted slaves, African Americans at the time, as being three-fifths of a human being for electoral purposes. It was meant to be a buffer so that the ruling class could always maintain the ability to pick leadership and to step away from the wants and desires of the people. That's why America is a republic, not a democracy. So if we want to be an advanced 21st century democracy, these are some of the things that need to go away, because this idea that you are enfranchising Iowa or red states by having electoral college is simply nonsense. That's not what exists currently. What exists currently is a way where in this century, since the year 2000, two of the three presidents did not win the popular vote because we figured out how to manipulate the system. And then whenever Republicans are not able to hold the popular vote or get the majority of the American people on their side for their position, they claim fraud and then never show any proof of fraud. Tell them to show you one instance where voter fraud has swayed an election, even an election for dog catcher or city janitor or something along those lines. It's a completely made-up argument that they use to depress the democratic needs of America and other countries. What they've also done is entrench conservatives and Federalist Society cult members into the U.S. judiciary. President Trump bragged about nominating over 300 judges and now has a 6-3 majority on the Supreme Court despite not winning the popular vote in 30 years. So this is the anti-democratic nature of the Republican Party that they're using to push down the desires of the majority of the American people, and they have to come to terms with that. It's not voter fraud the reason you haven't won any elections in the last 30 years. It's not voter fraud for why why you're seeing 70 million people, 75 million people at this point vote for Joe Biden and have a 4 to 5 million vote spread over Donald Trump. It's because their policies are unpopular and they're trying to hold up an oligarchical system which is anti-democratic and anti the will of the majority of the American people.
Now, Mr. Patillo, Mr. Logan did point out that the fact that mail-in ballots were counted does open up room for some kind of voter fraud, and he did elaborate on that. Don't you think that this has complicated the situation?
Not at all. Five states in the United States have used exclusively mail-in voting for over 30 years and never had an instance of in-person or of mail-in voter fraud. There have been no claims, no verifiable claims of any voter fraud as a result of these mail-in elections. President Trump has voted absentee in Florida for the last several years, including his children, Ivanka and Eric and Eric. It's the exact same thing. You put your vote in the mail and they send it in there. So they made up these boogeymen because they knew 6 months ago, based on polling, they were going to lose this election by millions of votes. So they had to explain why that, make an explanation for that. And that's why even in 2016, when President Trump lost by 3 million votes, he claimed that illegal immigrants and dead people were voting for him and offered no proof in 4 years to verify that. So they made these unsubstantiated claims to justify their oligarchical system, which is meant to depress the democratic needs of the majority of American people, and instead of simply owning up to that and adopting new policies that would be more in line with what the American people want, they continue to play to the ref, make up lies and deceit and fanciful tales about people burning ballots instead of simply saying our policies are unpopular with the American people and we need to change.
Thank you very much, Mr. Logan. Before I move on to the next question, I'd like to give you a chance to respond to Mr. Patillo on this case.
Okay, well, the whole thing, I think there are plenty of claims of actual voter fraud that are pretty credible and they should be looked into. Just because maybe you don't believe it, maybe you don't think they're actually accurate in your mind, does not mean that it shouldn't get looked into, okay? If there is an allegation made, look into it and see what's going on. If it's false, then it's false. If it's true, then it's true. And you're very good with your words. You're a lawyer, I suppose. I know you are. And you're talking about, well, there's been no actual voter fraud that swayed an election. I mean, come on. Like, maybe you didn't have 20 million people that had, you know, voter fraud, but maybe there was 100, 200, 1,000, 5,000. We really don't know until we investigate. There's a lot of things, I think, that are happening right now that we'll see in full color once we go through some discovery process, as you would say over there on your side. Once we figure out what's going on, then we can make an assertion. But until then, I think it's kind of irresponsible to say, oh, well, there's no evidence. No, look at the evidence, look at the claims, and then we can figure out what's happening.
Now, moving on to the next topic, Mr. Patillo, we've seen Trump supporters coming out on the streets armed with rifles. What are the prospects, in your opinion, of this election to become turn into something violent, basically?
I don't think it's going to turn into anything violent. We saw after President Obama was elected, there were threats on the right wing of violence. We saw after the Tea Party Revolution between 2012 and 2014, the same sorts of credible threats. Even in the 90s, we had the Michigan militia rising up. We had Ruby Ridge. We had Waco. We had far-right cults and separatist organizations that threatened the same thing. Understand that America is not is a very stable democracy. We have our squabbles. We have our same fights. But just as any other domestic squabble or domestic fight, we still come together thereafter. So I think America will recover. We will come back together. We'll understand that our differences are far smaller than what brings us together as a nation. And I think partially is the fact that President Trump came out and gave one of the most disgraceful speeches in American presidential history yesterday. Could you imagine President Ronald Reagan blaming others for why he lost? Could you imagine Dwight D. Eisenhower giving that sort of speech that President Trump did yesterday, or Abraham Lincoln, other Republicans, giving a sort of speech where you are blaming and crying and whining and fueling this fire of distrust and hatred in America? So having that sort of demagogue out of office, this is like Alcibiades in Greek history, the Lucius of the Athenians, who used his word to foment war and foment violence and dissension within the ranks. That's not what we do here in America, and I think that's been more so than ever proven by the fact that 3 million people voted against that message last time and 4 million plus Americans voted against that messaging this time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Logan. Do you believe that it might get violent or not?
No, I don't think so. People on the right generally don't do things like that as far as elections. Okay. If it doesn't go our way, we look at investigation, handling things legally. We don't go towards the streets and riot like the left does. We've seen Portland, Oregon descend into chaos, Los Angeles. We've seen cities all over the nation that have been in pure chaos for the past few months. We don't do that on the right. That's generally a leftist thing, okay? And then as far as, oh, the president had a disgraceful speech, well, let's talk about the past 4 to 5 years, shall we? The whole Russia collusion thing. They were saying, oh, well, the administration, they were colluding with Vladimir Putin and Ukraine and everybody else, maybe even China, to disrupt the election, to help him win. And then you had, what, about 3 years, $40 million, 500 subpoenas that yielded a big, fat, nothing burger, zero, zilch, nada, nothing. You had some underlings that got locked up on petty charges for like 5 days in the penitentiary, but nothing came as a result of that as it relates to Trump or any kind of collusion. Same thing with the Ukraine thing. They're talking about, oh, well, you had a phone call with the Ukrainians talking about he wants to investigate Joe Biden to help him in the 2020 election. Again, nothing from that. He got impeached, not removed. So it's funny how the left talk about we want a peaceful transition if you don't want to be a banana republic, but they are the very ones that are attempting that in this particular case, from the Russia thing to the Ukraine thing. And then when Ukraine and Russia allegations emerge as it relates to Joe Biden and his son, Hunter Biden, being in business together, all of a sudden, oh, that's a right-wing conspiracy theory, that's QAnon, it's Ruby Ridge, come on. This is really silly. I think the reason why this is like this as far as messaging is because the left control most of the media and also social media, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. They can control the messaging to make us appear like we're crazy, out of our mind. But then when they do what they accuse us of doing, then it's okay. Then it's, quote unquote, protecting their democracy. It's ridiculous.
Thank you very much, Mr. Logan. I'm very sorry to cut you off. We're running out of time. We have less than 2 minutes, and this final question is really crucial to wrap this up. Can the next president of the United States bridge the gap in this clearly polarized society? Mr. Logan.
Well, I don't know what Joe Biden can do or what Trump can do. I think it's all about the American people. What are we going to do? I think if you have somebody in there that's going to be inflammatory as far as saying, you know, cops are killing people and whatnot, that's not really going to make it go in the proper direction. If you have a guy in there that says, okay, let's come together, make the country better, I think that'll do wonders. It all depends on what each president's messaging is.
Thank you very much. And Mr. Patillo.
Let's understand, one, on that idea that Republicans are not rioting in the streets, let's understand Heather Heyer in Charlottesville is dead because of a right-wing militia. Kyle Rittenhour killed two people in Kenosha, Wisconsin with an assault rifle, and they let him go home. These are the types of right-wing lunatics that we're talking about. And on this idea of bringing the nation together, President Trump has had 4 years to bring the nation together. And with that disgraceful speech that he did last night, he has shown he has no ability to bring together the other 52% of Americans who disagree with him. Joe Biden, the president-elect right now, is the only person currently in power who has the ability to bridge that gap and heal the nation that we've needed for so many years.
Thank you very much, Mr. Robert Patel, Democratic strategist, and Anthony Brian Logan, conservative political commentator. Thanks to both.